In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Welcome to another edition of the Chicago Way, the finest podcast in the universe. Jeff Carlin from WGN Radio, one of the best producers in the world, producing the Rokan and Anna show. John Cass, your mild-mannered syndicated columnist. Later in the show, we're going to talk about Lamb in a Bridgeport church.
Mm-hmm.
Tax policy, which is always exciting, with John Tillman.
Goes well with Lamb.
Yeah, it does go well with Lamb, and a little yogurt and garlic, too. And the eclipse.
Right.
When I was a little boy, there were public service announcements for the eclipse. And the idea was, you know, it was a pinhole camera in a box. And the warnings were, do not look at it or you will burn your eyes out completely.
Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting point. And it's, I think, a major misunderstanding regarding this solar eclipse the sun is no more dangerous during the eclipse than it is normally. In fact, it's a little less dangerous because part of it is covered up. But usually you have no reason to want to stare at the sun. That really is the entire safety danger right there. You catch a glimpse of the sun in your eyes all the time, or if you're driving when the sun is low on the horizon, maybe it's right in your face, and you don't get blinded by that. So the partially eclipsed sun is really only a threat if you somehow stare at it for a long time.
I suppose we should introduce our guest, Jeff Carlin, since we just started geeking out on solar eclipse. Jeff Carlin is the man of science of this podcast.
Yes, joining us actually is Mark Hammergren from the Adler Planetarium. He's an astronomer there. He's researching on asteroids, meteorites, and solar bodies, if you will. Is that right there? An accurate description there, Mark?
Absolutely. I'm a planetary scientist, so anything within our solar system is fair game.
Excellent, excellent. Well, you know, obviously all the hype about the eclipse is coming up, and some people have asked me, well, you know, why is this eclipse so important? And I try to put on my scientist hat, but it's really, you know, it's wrinkly and it's got some rips in it. So I try to leave the real science to the actual scientists. But, Mark, why is it so important this time around?
You know, scientifically, the eclipse isn't as important as a solar eclipse might have been 100 or 200 years ago. We have satellites in orbit that can observe the sun in great detail 24 hours a day. So the scientific value isn't quite what it used to be, but the public value is still incredible. Everybody remembers. We were just talking about, you know, viewing an eclipse when you were a kid. This is something that sticks with you for your whole life, even just partial eclipses. And this is a great opportunity for people to feel connected to the rest of the universe, really, and also with each other in looking at something of really the natural beauty and interest.
How scary is it? Because I want to put myself in the position of, let's say I'm a Mayan priest about and sacrificing thousands of people, cutting their heads off on a temple.
Sure.
Or I am a knight. Jeff and I are two knights, say the 800s, 900s
sure, yeah.
in England, and we're about to do trial by combat, and all of a sudden this thing happens. I mean, how scary is it to people who don't know?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and really, you know, put yourself in that position. Like for this eclipse, this total eclipse is happening basically in the middle of August, towards the end of August, one of the hottest times of the year. The sun is high overhead. The sun is, of course, the giver of all life on the planet Earth. It's what makes the crops grow. It's what brings day to us. And all of a sudden, you see a shadow whipping in from the west, blotting out part of the sky. The sun grows dark over the course of a few seconds, and it's replaced by this ring of fire in the sky. It's a deep twilight around you. You can see the stars. You can see the some of the planets, like the planet Venus. And the air grows cold. Animals react as if night is coming on. And all of this comes on in the course of a few seconds, the totality itself. Because, unless you have glasses to view the sun, you don't see the partial phases very well. You don't perceive that very well. But the total eclipse comes on just like nightfall. And for that to happen in the middle of the day, when, of course, that never normally happens, would be incredibly eerie and just freaky.
And that's my favorite part about this whole thing, is kind of just imagining yourself back in an era where, like you said, you have no idea what's coming or why it's happening, but it is, and all of a sudden, there it is. But this one's really special because it's the first time since the founding of this country that's going to transit completely within the continental U.S., right? Is that right?
Well, this one stretches from coast to coast, so that part is right. Yeah, we've had other total solar eclipses within the United States. The last total eclipse, though, was visible from the States in 1979, so almost 40 years ago. There have been a few partial eclipses throughout the intervening time, but not a total eclipse. And that's what really, that and the very long stretch across the country make this one so special.
All right, so just so I get it straight in my head, I can look at the eclipse. I don't have to sit, put a box over my head with two pinholes. I can actually look at the eclipse and just stare right at it, and I won't burn my eyes out. Yes or no?
No, you can't stare at it. You never want to stare at the sun. A quick glimpse out of the corner of your eye isn't going to hurt you, but if you want to view it, you do need either special eclipse glasses, a certain grade of welding goggles, grade number 14 welding goggles, or one of those pinhole projectors, which is an easy way to view the eclipse. So that'll actually let you see the crescent sun that we will see here from Chicago.
So I'm not supposed to look at it, put my head in a box, make the pinhole thing.
That's a great way to watch the eclipse over a long period of time, yeah.
Yeah, but you just took all the fun out of it.
And, Mark, I know in the past, and I don't know if it's the case still, but eclipses are coveted because it is an opportunity to stare out into the universe with this big blind spot. Do people still use the eclipse for scientific purposes, or have we kind of know everything we need to know about an eclipse or about the benefits of it to us?
So that's a good question. There are still some good things that can be done in science during an eclipse, because the disk of the moon will blot the main bright portion of the sun's face out, and that exposes and allows us to observe the very thin outer atmosphere of the sun, called the corona. And that's where the solar wind is escaping from the sun. We can't normally see that because it's just blotted out by the incredibly bright sun. So people who study the corona, who try to figure out what is it that heats that gas, that drives that gas, they can do studies during eclipse that they can't do normally.
Now, it's going to happen when again?
This is going to be, for us, it'll start around a little before noon on Monday, August 21st, and reach its largest coverage a little after 1 p.m., about 1:19 p.m., I believe.
So what is the planetarium doing with students? And I know kids aren't in school yet, at least I know soccer players and football players are going to practice, but what is going on there with for young people to get them, to help them, take those first few steps into the scientific and natural world?
Yeah, there's a tremendous interest in the solar eclipse from everybody of all ages. So the Adler, we are responding with a gigantic block party in front of the planetarium and offering free admission, solar eclipse glasses, pinhole viewer construction. We've got all kinds of fun activities for the littlest kids up to the oldest adults. And this will be the place to be in Chicago. We'll have a crowd of people who are all interested in seeing the same thing. So the shared social event is really going to be a big part of this.
Are we supposed to wear any particular clothing to this event, like dark purple robes with peaked, with conical hats with stars and moons on them, or...
That sounds great if you want to. Yeah, yeah. I do recommend clothes.
Just generally speaking, for science, that's a good idea. Mark, so this is going to be a while before the United States experiences this again. If I've got those glasses, I do have a pair that the Adler sent over to us at the radio station. And should I hang on to them? What's the lifespan on those things? Or rather, when will I need them again?
Yeah, so the glasses should they should preserve themselves quite well as long as the mylar is protected. It's very interesting. After a long spate of no eclipses, we're having another solar eclipse, a total solar eclipse, coming through this area in 2024. So a little less than 7 years from now, there'll be a total eclipse stretching from Texas up through Maine. And coincidentally, also passing through southern Illinois. So cities like Carbondale will get covered by totality in both of these eclipses.
Why? That seems like it's of all the randomness and all the possibilities in the universe, for that to happen twice in the span of a few, relatively a few years. Why is that? What sets that up?
Well, total eclipses from any one location are pretty rare, but they're actually not that uncommon when you look at the entire globe. We might have anywhere from zero to maybe three total solar eclipses in a year. And that band of totality will stretch randomly around some part of the world. So when you look at a period of a decade or so, there are a number of places where multiple eclipses just kind of cross over each other. Most of the time, of course, that's out in the middle of the ocean. Sometimes you do have it in the middle of a populated area, like Carbondale, Illinois.
Got it. Okay. Excellent. Well, Mark, I appreciate your time. We're looking forward to this on August 21st. Any last tips you have for anybody who, is it really going to be that much different from Chicago to Carbondale, or do you think people should try to transit themselves down to Carbondale to really experience, or will the effect, you think, be as strong and lasting if someone's up here in Chicago?
Yeah, the difference between a partial eclipse and a total eclipse is literally difference between day and night. The experience during totality is nothing like what you'd see in the partial eclipse. So you've really got to be in that band of totality. Now, that said, there are no hotels available in any of the populated areas. Traffic is going to be horrendous. It's maybe a little bit late to plan an excursion down to totality, but if you can make it, if you're not too far from it, I definitely recommend going the few extra miles. Otherwise, though, come to the Adler. Come to some of the other viewing events in the area. A lot of public libraries are going to have safe viewing events. And, it happens in a great time of day. A little after 1 o'clock is when you get the maximum coverage. And that makes for a great late lunch. Just come down to the Adler and view the eclipse with tens of thousands of your friends.
As long as people don't do any bizarre religious practices right around the time that the sun is blotted out, I'll be good. I'll be there.
Yeah, that's great. I haven't heard of any apocalyptic cults or anything.
Thank you for that.
My pleasure.
Mark, thanks so much for spending your time with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here, and happy eclipse viewing.
We're always looking up.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring.
So joining us now is John Tillman, CEO of the Illinois Policy Institute, and you just walked into the Tribune Tower and asked for me, and what happened?
They said, John, who? And then they asked for the spelling of your name three times, and then they looked through the little directory thing there, and they asked what company, and I said the Tribune Company. And I'm an old retailer, John, and this reminded me of people would walk into my store where I'd been for 10 years, and I'd say, hey, is this your first visit? Yeah, I just noticed you. I said, oh, you're new to the neighborhood? No, I've lived here 20 years. This is why we all got to keep selling.
Yes, and we all – and but you know what? As the only – or two – one of two conservatives left here, you'd think that they'd know me, Jeff Carlin.
You'd think so.
But maybe not. Okay, that's got to be some sort of harbinger of things to come, but I don't want to deal with that right now.
So you do have a moving company on speed dial, don't you, John?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So I could go to my tiny house in Indiana.
The media business is very stable and predictable right now.
Well, let's put it this way. Truth and righteousness are always stable because they're always constant.
That's actually one of my favorite lines is that we have truth on our side. And as long as we remember that, we can get through some of the challenges.
So the Illinois Policy Institute, which I've known for a long time, and has been identified in the public prints most recently as a right-wing, scary organization. If I look at the columns from pundits I read, all of them left, far left of center in Chicago, but that's how it works. The Illinois Policy Institute people have gone over to help Governor Rauner try to salvage his administration and maybe get him on the path. And we've talked about this before. I've talked about this on the podcast before with others. And now we have you here. So, John Tillman, are the characterizations of the Illinois Policy Institute as the evil right-wing organization grasping the mind of Rauner as if you were a bunch of Rasputins. Is that...
It's one of the most ridiculous memes I've seen developed since I've been involved in this. I've been a business guy most of my life. I've actually lived a life before this, and I had some small businesses, almost went bankrupt once. That was a lot of fun. And have dealt with the Chicago bureaucracy and all that it is, and then get involved in public policy, and suddenly you become a right-wing radical. Nothing could be further from the truth, although I wear the label conservative proudly. But the people who are making those comments are hardcore advocates on the other side. They are the people who believe in the status quo. They believe that Mike Madigan's speakership and leadership of the state, chairman of the Democrat Party, has been very good. And our basic premise is that the problem in the state is not a Democrat and Republican problem. It's not a conservative versus liberal problem. It's a political infrastructure, the Madigan machine versus the people. And the people are Democrats, Republicans, independents. People that maybe read your column, John, or listen to your podcast are more engaged than the average person. But most people in the state don't wear their partisan loyalties on their sleeve. It's not as deeply rooted in their life. The people that are saying these disparaging things are. But we're
One thing about them, and I just want to make a point. When I write about it, I say what I am. People know. I say I'm a conservative. That's who I am. I say it. I say I don't like Madigan. I say it. The ones who are ripping on you on the Illinois Policy Institute going on, they don't say, I love Madigan. They don't say that they're liberals. They're kind of like they come from an alleged neutral position, which I find to be intellectually dishonest.
It is intellectually dishonest. And one of the things I've learned since I went from being sort of an engaged citizen to being extremely engaged at a high level is there is no neutrality. People are on one side or the other. And the point I'm making is what the Illinois Policy Institute fights for is to try to help every Illinois citizen, poor, disadvantaged, and especially the middle class, live a better life here. And the status quo, the elites in Illinois, led by Speaker Madigan and his allies in the General Assembly, they have destroyed that. And again, it's not partisan. This is about the people in charge of our government and how they are taking away people's property wealth, record high property taxes. We now have higher income taxes. We have the fifth highest overall tax burden. Trying to start and grow a business in the city of Chicago is sort of a dystopian nightmare. It really is incredible. And they have done this for what purpose? The political class profits from the power and control. And that's what this is really about. And the people who pay the price are average folks, Democrat, Republican, Independent alike.
My argument has been I would hold the same standard if we were in a Republican state, Republican bosses, Republican machine. It's just that this happens to be a Democratic boss with Democratic machine and a Democratic blue state.
Well, this is an important point, and it goes to some of the work that we have done. The main reason we have critics is because we have held Republicans accountable just as much as we have Democrats, and Republicans don't like that. Republicans would prefer to only be held accountable by the forces of the left, and they would like everybody that is theoretically a force on the right to just be their lapdog. We are not here for partisan purposes. We are here to advance the cause of free markets and free people and try to help the powerless gain some level of personal prosperity. And when we think of prosperity, we don't think of just material prosperity, though that's good and well. We think about the prosperity of the human condition, the idea that people should live an enriching life here. You know, the left is the one who's really fixated on money. There's a lot of people who live their lives in a fully enriched way, prosperous way, that has nothing to do with money, whether it's your passion to coach kids in Little League soccer or baseball or football or whatever it might be, or if you're an artist, a musician, somebody who just wants to stay home and raise your kids or teach or whatever it is. And that's what we're fighting for every day.
Before we go on, I do have to mention the movie.
Yes, the movie.
This was a point of contention. Remember this, Jeff Carlin?
Yep.
I'm surprised you're bringing it up, John.
I do
John
bring it up.
John fears no, he didn't do anything wrong.
I not do anything wrong, I was all up.
Yeah, up and
Let's
up.
Just say what happened. The Illinois Policy Institute helped put together a documentary on Madigan. And I said, yes, I'll sit down and talk. And the Illinois Policy Institute has never misrepresented itself.
Right.
I knew exactly what they were about, because my argument, I've had these arguments before I knew you guys.
Right.
On Madigan, before really the Illinois Policy Institute started going. I mean, I was writing about the Combine and Boss Madigan and so forth. So I saw nothing wrong in it. Then what happened? It became... I did not go to my superiors and ask them, should I do a documentary with a group, or at least be part of a documentary with a group that was involved with supporting Bruce Rauner? And it was understood that I should have come to them first because even though you guys supported Bruce Rauner and I supported Bruce Rauner personally in the column and the newspaper did, I should have disclosed it. So I apologized. And the reason I, to the readers for not disclosing, the reason I bring it up is because I don't want anything about this discussion to be colored by, oh, he didn't mention it or he didn't say it.
Right.
Because that's in the past, and that really does, to me, it means nothing.
Well, I think there's a couple things there, John. First of all, I want to just correct a couple little things,
yeah.
That details that would, there's no reason for you to know, but it's important from us, from a compliance point of view. We actually did the movie through our sister organization, Illinois Policy, which is governed differently than
correct.
Illinois Policy Institute, but same team, mm-hmm. although legally different. And the second thing is that we've been very supportive of Governor Rauner's policies and supportive of his and critical of some of his policies. And one of the things that a lot of people have written with our staff going on to his team is that, geez, he's bringing in all these people who've been critical of him. So we've done both. But we're not supporting him because we're not allowed to by law. So we cannot support his candidacy. We can support his policies. What we all do in our personal lives outside of our nonprofit work is fine, just like you. You have
right.
personal views that don't represent the Tribune's views.
Although I do give all my personal views.
Yes, well, that's what's great about having that platform, which is amazing and, you know, is a must read. But the important thing about the movie, I thought, first of all, I thought you were very stand up about the whole thing. I wish everybody had been as stand up as you were. Some people, frankly, squirmed a little bit when the mm-hmm. scrutiny got there. And we didn't mislead anybody about what the role was. And we were very transparent about it. Some people chose to ask more questions than others. That's not on us to figure out. That's on them to figure out. So, you know, it was what it was. But the movie was terrific. 2.7 million people saw Summer. All of that in a state of 12.8 million people. We had tremendous market penetration with that movie.
And the message is still constant. In my mind, and this is not to disparage a man personally, because in terms of personality, personally, Michael Madigan to me should have been a conservative Republican. Right. He is fiscally, in his own life, fiscally disciplined. He believes in institutions outside of government, church and neighborhood groups and so forth. But he grew up in the machine era of Chicago. He's taken advantage of it. And to me, as long as he's in charge, I don't see anything developing or moving in this state.
Well, I agree with that assessment. I also agree with a predicate assessment about Speaker Madigan. If he'd been born in DuPage County into this, what was then the robust Republican circles, he'd be the longest Republican-serving speaker in the history of the state because he is agnostic on policy and philosophy. His primary driver is political power. And, you know, I'm guessing he's worth over $100 million all because of his property tax appeals law firm. And that money flows out of average working class people's pockets and the corporate clients that he has into his pocket. He's never revealed how much he's worth. I think he ought to not only reveal his tax returns so people could see, I think he ought to provide a balance sheet so that we could see just how wealthy he's become on the backs of taxpayers in Illinois.
And doubling the problem, Jeff Carlin, for people in Illinois is that the large institutional landowners downtown that use Michael Madigan for their tax reducer business are in many cases run by Republicans in the sense that the Republican Party, what I call the combine part of it, has basically benefited or subsidized the boss of the Democratic Party, and who ends up paying the difference?
Me.
The suburbs and the middle class and you.
That's exactly right. And, you know, people can, by the way, see the movie at michaelmadigan.com if they would like to.
How did you guys get that registry?
Address?
Yeah, it seemed like it would have been taken.
It's one of the great joys of my life is the day that our VP of marketing came in to see me, Ryan Green, and said, you won't believe the address we just got. And apparently nobody thought about registering that to you know, for his own benefit.
Oh, that's
interesting.
Well, let's look at what's going on in the next week or so. The education bill.
Right.
Our good friend and Stan Donuts smuggler, Kristen McQuarrie, just came out with a column which surprised the heck out of the Rauner people, saying lawmakers reject Rauner's changes on school funding, basically telling the Democrats and the Republicans overturn, you know, veto this, change it. Don't go with the Rauner veto.
Well, I certainly disagree with her sentiment. I have great respect for Kristen. I think she's one of the finest thinkers on public policy and politics in the state. But I think she's missed the mark on this one for several reasons. Some of her criticisms are absolutely on the money. I think one of the things that has frustrated people on the inside, as well as people like myself and our team, as well as advocates, Democrat, Republican alike, and school officials, is the inability of the government, the permanent infrastructure of government, to actually score the bill. It's taken one of the things we keep.
What does that mean for
that? That's a great question. Score the bill means to take the language and then say, okay, here's how the money will actually flow based upon the language. And I think it really illustrates why the amendatory veto that the governor did was the right policy, despite what Kristen says. What the policy's intent was to level the playing field between Chicago and the rest of the state. For a host of reasons, Chicago has had some unfair advantages for a long time in terms of how state money is distributed to schools around the state. And the governor's goal, as I understand it, was to level the playing field. So he took Senate Bill 1, which is the baseline bill, that put into place this idea of evidence-based funding, which I have some criticisms of, but some people love. And it's a very complex, filled with all kinds of things and carve-outs for Chicago. And he amended it. And as part of that amendatory veto, he took what are called PTEL districts and TIF districts. The acronyms don't matter. What it means is these are districts that can hide their property wealth. And because they hide their property wealth, it means the state will then give them more money from the state funding.
Chicago TIFs are
$6.7 billion is what the one estimate is. And then there's about another $5 billion plus around the rest of the state. And so the whole point is that money should be part of the equation, and that's what he did with this amendatory veto. The thing I think that has surprised everybody, including me, and this is just a problem, is that the Illinois Department of Revenue can't seem to figure out how to calculate the numbers. And I think it illustrates the larger problem which the governor addressed, which is this is way too complex. It's way too complex, and it needs to be simplified and streamlined. But I think that the right policy is what the governor did with the amendatory veto. The Democrats now have a choice to support that along with Republicans, or they can override him and let Senate bill in its original form become the law of the land, or they can all negotiate and find a third way that finds common ground and a compromise, which is what I hope happens.
And if they don't, if let's put it this way, when all the dust settles, why, I live in the suburbs now, okay? I've been out there for 20 years. We moved out there because I didn't want to have to clout my kids into a magnet school, and anybody who thinks that journalists or people who know people aren't approached about stuff like that, you're sadly mistaken. You live in a fantasy world without dragons. And I didn't want to do that. So we moved out to the suburbs, and now I feel whatever happens, suburbs are going to get dinged. Why do I feel that way?
Because the suburbs have long been getting dinged. This is the institutional pattern of the state of Illinois, is that the politicians who control things, who are all in the city, continually ding suburban and downstate taxpayers in order to alleviate the pain of mismanagement in the city. Remember what's going on here. And I do think it's unfortunate and somewhat sad, frankly, that we have this sort of city versus the rest of the state. But here's why it's happening. It's happening because the city wants to be bailed out in a variety of ways. It's not just CPS funding. It's the city of Chicago. It's Cook County. And it goes on and on with the large operations, government operations controlled by Speaker Madigan, Mayor Emanuel, President Preckwinkle, and others. They have failed to solve their problems. Their spending is out of control, and their revenues can't keep up with it. So they're in perpetual deficit, and they're borrowing money to actually operate the business. It's like living off your credit cards to buy your groceries. That's what all these units of government are doing. And in order to fix the spending, they have to take on the public sector unions. They have to take on the Chicago Teachers Union and Karen Lewis. They have to take on the various unions that work for the city and the county. And the political leaders, the ones I just mentioned, don't want to do that. That's scary and painful for them because it's their political allies. So it's the path is easier to go to Springfield and say, give us more money out of the total coffers that come out of downstate and suburban taxpayers. And that's why they get dinged.
John, since Illinois policies launched in 2002, what do you think some of the achievements you guys – I know obviously the system here in Illinois has been kind of broken for decades.
Right.
And since you guys came on the scene, what do you feel like you – what's been your impact on the state of Illinois?
That's a great question, Jeff. Briefly, it was founded by a guy named Greg Blankenship in 2002 after 9/11. And Greg did a good job getting it off the ground in the beginning through 2007. Then I became CEO then. Prior to my arrival, they did a great job of helping to fight against the gross receipts tax under Governor Blagojevich. Since we've been here, I think the number one thing we've done is we've built a large megaphone so that the pro-free market point of view, those ideas actually get currency now instead of having the monopoly control of the other side's point of view. So I think it's the biggest thing is that we have a very large audience. We can compete with the mainstream media to build audience and get out our narrative. That's number one. I think number two is we have made the landscape much more, you know, politicians run for office and win. Nonprofits like us don't do that. But what we have done is made the ground much more fertile for somebody like Governor Rauner to have won. Now, he gets credit for his victory, but the landscape upon which he ran was changed and the cultural narrative was changed. One really good example of that is that when we got here, the whole argument was always about we don't have enough revenue and that we have a revenue problem. And we've been pretty effective at conveying that it's actually a spending problem, not a revenue problem. And even the Democrats, when they just overrode the governor and raised taxes 32%, admit they have a spending problem. I think we've done a very good job of bringing school choice into the public domain. And I think especially property taxes and the abuse of property taxpayers and middle-class taxpayers in general, we've done a very good job of bringing that to fruition. To get transformational change, we're going to have to see if we have a different makeup of the legislature, because the current makeup, as John has pointed out, is hostile to any of the pro-market reforms that we advocate for that are just commonplace in states all around us.
And it seems like a lot of the problems here stem from the, you know, the constitution in the state, that there's a lot of ways that it politicians use it to their advantage, and some would say abuse it to their advantage. How do you address that? Because I feel like 9 times out of 10, there's a discussion, well, we can't fix this because the Constitution would have to be changed. Well, we can't fix this because the Constitution would be changed. Well, the Constitution was changed so those things could be done the way they're doing and benefit certain people. So it happened once.
So there's three ways to change the Constitution. One is a constitutional convention, and there's an automatic every 20-year ballot measure to determine whether the people want to call for a constitutional convention. The last time was 2008, and it went down in flames. The people did not want that. The primary reason that people do not want that is they're terrified that Speaker Madigan will control the convention and make things even worse. So I was in that mindset. The second way that you can change the Constitution is through the initiative process. But the actual Constitution restricts the initiative process so severely that it's impractical on its face, and I think the governor's efforts at term limits and the remaps that he and others were part of in 2014 are a good example of that, when the Supreme Court didn't even allow it to get a vote. Then the third way to change the Constitution, which is actually the most viable way and has been attempted a couple of times, is for the legislature, through a supermajority vote, a three-fifths supermajority, to refer out a measure for the people to then vote on. And that is very doable if you have a three-fifths supermajority. So in order for the people of this state to get the kind of constitutional reforms you're looking for, you have to have a three-fifths majority in the General Assembly, House and Senate, open to that. And the current people who control those chambers are hostile to all the reforms necessary. And this goes back to what I always like to say, is people should vote, speaking generically and my personal opinion, people should vote their values, what they want the state to become, not their party ID. And, yeah, elected officials have to wear a label, but it's really important to see what they represent from an idea point of view and make your choices accordingly. And if that starts to happen, which it started to happen this last election when the Republicans picked up 5 seats, 4 net in the House, I think you could start to see some changes and some of those ideas come to the fore.
Well, you also have Quislings. I don't know. Can I use that term?
I think we said you could.
Okay, Quislings.
We have to define it for people.
Well, I'm not talking about the last, you know, whenever anyone brings up that aspect of World War II in a discussion, the discussion's over, right? Isn't there a law on that?
Yeah.
So I'm not bringing that up in that sense. I'm just talking about traitors. Right. You could call them Ephialtes, which is even the word, because there's no Greek that ever named his son Ephialtes. You know why?
Why?
Because Ephialtes was the traitorous Spartan who led Xerxes' people around the mountain path to attack the 300 Spartans from the side.
I just read that. That's amazing you're bringing that up.
Where'd you read it from? Victor Davis Hanson?
No, or maybe that was where. Maybe that's where it was. I don't remember. I never heard that before.
Donald Kagan has also done great like 5 volumes. Mm-hmm. I don't know how he could be. He could have been a neocon after writing that, but he was. Anyway, so that's it. Ephialtes or whatever. We have Republicans in the suburbs who. There's one picture of one who was basically kissing Michael Madigan's hand after the raising the, you know, he's in Arlington Heights. Harris, I believe, right?
Right, Harris, and then
Steve
Anderson.
Mr. Anderson.
He was very unhappy with us because we've certainly put a lot of – this goes back to the point I made. We focus on the policy, not the party, and we put a lot of pressure on Republicans, and they're very disturbed by that. But the point of this story in terms of the Quislings, there's basically three kinds of elected officials. There are those who are principle-driven, who vote based upon some philosophical idea. This is true of Democrats and Republicans. Then there are
usually they're gentlemen planters with plenty of time.
Exactly. Right? And then the second category are what I would call union-funded legislators. They both on the Democrat and Republican side, they get most of their money and financial support and lobbying interest from the public sector unions. And then the third ones are what I'll just call the agnostics. They just sort of wait and see which way the wind's blowing and what they think is in their short-term interest, and they go in the direction that they think momentum is.
And there's some that are funded by Republican business interests as well.
Yes, but if you actually go – I've actually studied this. If you go and look at the funding of House members from both parties, it is really stunning and revealing. On average, most new members on the Republican side are funded by individuals who write checks – individual people, and occasionally small business owners. Once Republicans get in office, over time, you see they still have a lot of that, but then you start to see the institutionalized lobbying organizations like Exelon's lobbying group, the retailer associations, mm-hmm. or whoever. The political infrastructure starts to fund them the longer they're there. On the Democrat side, those infrastructure funders are always there, and then the unions are the big funders and the trial bar.
If there aren't any changes, I've been making a joke in the column about living in a tiny house and under the where is it?
Rensselaer. Is
Rensselaer
that
under those windmills. Just
right.
Because
yep.
We pass by them, they seem so bleak. It's like a perfect place to drink cheap whiskey and think about home, like
never,
Illinois.
Never drink cheap whiskey, John.
Well, I would
Good
there
point.
If I lived there. But the jokes aside. We're at a point now where people are finally coming to understand what you've been saying, what I've been saying. But many, according to the census data and the Illinois Policy Institute and others, left and right, people are leaving the state in droves.
Yeah.
So these are the same 150,000 people or something like that. These are the people who would turn an election and usually want to go for some sort of free market reform of machine practices. Now they're leaving. So when do we – are we hitting – have we already passed the turning point?
There is still hope, John, despite that dour little summer you just did. There's
still hope. Well, I mean, you have to look at numbers, buddy.
No, I know
that. When I see throngs running, you know, across the horizons running from the Seljuks on horseback, you have to think.
You've certainly nailed it. I agree with everything you just said, but here's why we can still be optimistic. I've lived here 32 years. I moved here in 1985, made this my home, raised my daughter here, and I love Chicago. I love Illinois, but I grew up in Michigan. And in the 80s, when I was in college, the very early 80s, the running joke was, last one to leave, please turn out the lights. And Michigan was going through exactly what we were going through. They were going through depopulation, led the country in people moving out. And the same sentiment was felt that all the people who are sort of, you know, productive and could vote for better choices and vital are going to Texas and Indiana, whatever. And there's some truth to that. But what ended up happening over a period of time is that the people that were left eventually had enough and started voting differently. And so they put in a new a political team and a new governor, new legislature. It was all Democrat controlled. Now it's all Republican controlled. And by the way, this doesn't mean Republicans are the panacea.
No.
I want to emphasize that over and over again. This really isn't about Republican and Democrat. No. It's about the ideas. But in that case, the incumbent there was the Democrat Party. If you go to some other states where they're Republican-controlled, it's quite conceivable.
Alaska,
Oklahoma, South Carolina. These are all places where they have severe problems and are Republican control. But anyway, my point is that the new team, though, was elected on a reform agenda, did the reforms, and Michigan is booming. Michigan now has a higher rate of growth in manufacturing jobs than Illinois. Michigan is now gaining population. One of the hottest growth areas in the country is West Michigan, over by where I grew up. And in suburban Detroit, it's going well. And downtown Detroit is actually starting to recover. So it can turn around very quickly. We've done dug a damn big hole.
The difference is, sir, that in Detroit, there are tracts of land that are used as farms in downtown Detroit.
Yes.
Do we have to get to the farmlands where Jeff and I have 50 chickens and a couple pigs and roosters, nanny mm-hmm. goats, mm-hmm. like Wilford Brimley? Wilford Brimley and the natural, like to have that down here?
Yeah.
Well, before we get there,
I hope we can learn the lesson sooner. And in the end, John, it's going to be up to the people of Illinois to learn that lesson and choose different leadership.
John, you were speaking earlier about the idea of money coming into people, and you know, that a lot of small, you know, newer to the game, they get individual donations and mm-hmm. kind of build. And then once they get into the mainstream of the politics of our state, they get sucked into this slipstream of funds from labor groups and you know, guests and all that. Ever thought about maybe trying to help push forward an initiative to require legislators to wear a jacket with like their all their sponsors on them, like they do in
like
NASCAR.
A NASCAR?
Yeah,
you mean like all the nicknames? Like I used to give people nicknames, but a whole thing?
No. Like Exelon, they'd have to have an Exelon patch on them, and if the size of the patch would be, you know, essentially an example of how much relative to everyone else that they're giving to that one person. So if you have a person who's a gigantic individual patch on their back, you know that person's for the people. They're not taking money from big business.
Right.
But if it's all big business patches and tiny little individual patch, then I know a lot.
Or if you have a jacket made of Clem Belanoff's face. I like Clem. I mean, I get along with him, but still, right? I mean, we're on different sides politically.
Right.
Something like that, right?
Right. I think that would really help our state.
So we have a great cartoonist, Eric Alley, and his work is some of the most penetrating work that we have. He's really imaginative and creative, and I'm going to be sharing this idea with him.
Excellent.
To put this into cartoon form. I love this idea. And, you know, money, I am for a complete transparency in terms of political money because they're the ones who have power. We are supported by over 3,000 private citizens, from a buck, you know, or two or three or four, to people who've given us over $1 million and everything in between, but all individuals.
But also Rauner as well, right?
He donated to us up through 2013.
Right.
He gave us somewhere, I don't have the exact number in front of me, but somewhere around $600,000. Our annual budget's about $12 million. So over a period of years, we're very grateful for those very significant donations. But
just to
to be a tiny percentage.
Rather, in case some trolls in Springfield want to hear, listen to this.
Perpetual trolls. There's always one on my shoulder somewhere.
Right, exactly. Also, on Jeff's theme, because Jeff, that's a brilliant idea, and if I ever steal it, I will give you full credit for
it. No problem.
I've always wondered, do you remember a guy named Artie Berman, Jeff? Right? Jeff Carlin? Artie Berman, senator?
I don't remember
right?
him.
Art Berman, right? State senator in charge of education. And was always talking about for the children, for the children.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, boy.
And I think he has, like, this huge pension. I don't even know if he's alive. He might not be alive. But when I hear for the children, we have to do this for the children, or whatever they say, the cliches that come.
Right.
I always wondered, why can't we know in real time what their estimated pension would be?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question, and maybe we'll work on that, too. I think that these are all interesting ideas. We spend a lot of time on
it. Can you do all the research for me so Jeff and I can just
Well, that is kind of what we're here to do, is serve you. And
no, seriously, though. No, why shouldn't people know when John Cullerton is talking or Madigan is talking or any Republican, pick him, choose, whatever, so you're saying something about money that I'm going to end up paying in taxes, I should know, what are you coming away from this game with?
I love this idea. So here's what we want to try to do. So, you know, now when those left-wing radical extremists talk about us, those newspaper people talk about us or pundits, they always say, you know, the arch-conservative or whatever,
right?
That's always part of the moniker. So what we should do from now, and Senate President John Cullerton, who stands to receive $2.7 million in pension retirement benefits, said today, blah, 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 blah. That's what we should do. Now, by the way, I made up that number. I don't know what his actual number is.
You could also throw, like I do with Cullerton, I always say Democrat DeLeo, because Jimmy DeLeo helped make him Senate president. And if you don't believe it, I'm sorry, believe in dragons then. Mm-hmm. And also Tavern on Rush, which is Jeff Carlin's favorite hangout. I always see Jeff.
He's a little young to go there. Right?
Jeff in the afternoon before the Rocon show, he's out there hanging out with the guys.
Yeah, that's me. You
in the sweatsuit and the gold chains.
Do you put the pinky ring on?
Only on Wednesdays.
He does smell. When he smells like Paco Rabanne, you know that he's been there. So, okay. So, yeah, but I think, shouldn't the people know what, I mean, is there an
audience? It's all available, and there are a variety of websites, and we certainly have published that information. But I think we could probably do a better job of relentlessly communicating it, especially for some of the more prominent legislative leaders.
I think everybody who makes a statement about where taxes should go, we have to do more for pensions, less for pensions, whatever. Let people know what your pension is, because there are hardworking state employees.
Absolutely.
Who do a great job, and they've been sold down the river because it's going to come to a crash. It comes to a crash again.
There's no money there.
There's no money there. So it always, right, Jeff?
Absolutely.
Soon it runs out, and then everyone's going to be like, why didn't you tell us, Jeff Carlin? And you're going to say, you should have listened to this podcast with John Tillman.
Absolutely.
John Tillman? Thanks for being here with us today.
Well, thanks for having me. If people want to learn more about our work, they can go to illinoispolicy.org.
You know, every year in Chicago on August 15th, it's the day of the Assumption of the Virgin Mary. It is a holy day. Many churches, Western and East, Roman Catholic, Orthodox, have religious observances. And in one church on the south side in Bridgeport, St. Jerome's Roman Catholic Church, there has been a festival for the past, I think, 104 years continuously in Chicago. Our guest, a guy that I cooked lamb with this week, John Kosick, a neighbor, Croatian, and a crazy lamb man himself. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
What's going on back there? I hear a lot of bouncing around with the phone. Sit down still. Don't. Are you cooking lamb now? Are you tying it or something?
We're just preparing.
Just preparing.
Cleaning up.
Okay. Yeah. So tell us about the festival in the church.
St. Jerome's Christian Church, founded in 1912. Bought it from a Lutheran congregation, Chicago. And we've been celebrating the Feast of the Assumption at our parish since then. On that day, so whenever August 15th falls, we celebrate it. So it'll be a weekday, Sunday weekend. It's always been celebrated. And I'll tell you real quick, this is probably now third generation of creations that are participating and volunteering, helping with the feast day. So it's a nice tradition.
All right. So John is a big John and Jeff both helped me when there was a lamb catastrophe at my house. They had to chop the lamb was falling apart. They didn't tie it right.
Unbalanced.
They didn't tie it right, and I had to chop them up and basically roast them in kettles.
Let's set the scene though. It was a full lamb on John's front. Right in front of his garage on a spit roasting, but then it was unbalanced, the head between the legs, and so it started to cock itself around.
My big fat Greek Easter.
So then the whole thing started, it was kind of walking its way down his driveway as it was rotating. So we had to...
It wasn't that bad, but it was about to, and I think three of us were drinking Ouzo shots at the moment.
Nah, that sounds right.
Now, but that was one lamb. The lamb men of the... St. Jerome's cook, I think 70 or 80 lambs. What's going on with 70 or 80 lambs?
70 and about 20 pigs. We throw in a few because there's some people that like pork. So we got to help them out a little bit.
And for those of you, if you hear this after the event, you've missed it. But if it's out before the event, you can... drop by St. Jerome's in the morning, right, and purchase some lamb for your family, correct?
It's sold by the pound, half a lamb to buy as well as a whole. You can order it that morning. It'll be ready probably 8, 9 a.m. before Mass, and people start buying and take it home, and they go to Mass and eat at home because they live in the neighborhood. It'll be available through the afternoon. So, you know, if you like lamb and you have time on a Tuesday, come to Bridgeport, 29th Princeton. Enjoy the celebration for the feast day as well as the after events. There's games for kids. There's stuff for adults to do. Raffles, bingo, good creation music, and a little bit of Italian throwing as well.
There's stuff for adults to do the night before in the parking lot. Where John Cass and John Cusick and I don't know how many hundred crazy Croatian guys. Oh, by the way, there's a big debate between the three peoples that are the most civilized of the earth. Many more, too. The Armenians say they cook the best lamb. The Serbians say they cook the best. The Croatians say they cook the best. The Greeks say they cook the best. Who cooks the best lamb, mister?
I would have to say the Croatian, but I'm not being partial. And my brother is Greek also, so I'm going to give my hat kudos to him too. He makes a good lamb. It's the camaraderie, so let's say it's almost even. So all four groups are pretty strong in the camaraderie, so that helps a lot when you cook the lamb.
Well, we will make sure that I will purchase some lamb after I help cook it from you. And I'll bring it to our next Game of Thrones podcast here Tuesday morning. So thanks a lot, John Cusick. And I will see you since we're
Tuesday.
Taping this before.
Awesome.
Yeah, I will see you there. And by
thanks
the way,
the, la-
the last thing, John, the name, yeah. Say it in Croatian, the name of the festival.
Velika Gospa.
All right. Now, this relates to the Croatian people fighting off the Turks about what? How many hundreds of years ago? What's the legend?
400, 500. It was in the city of Sin. It was under siege. And this is what the people that came to America, the immigrants from Sin, they're the ones that wanted to continue this celebration. And our celebration of the feast day is second to the city of Sin in Croatia. I mean, it's known over there. So when people from Chicago, St. Jerome's visit Sin on the feast day, they were welcome to open ours. I mean, you can stay for free at people's homes. I mean, Our church is like a church over there, so we're like family, even though we're not related. I'm from St. Trump's. Your door's open. So it's a huge thing over in Croatia that we celebrated here in the United States as much as over there. So it's amazing.
That's great. John Kosick and St. Jerome's Church, Roman Catholic Church, 29th in Princeton, on the Assumption of the Virgin. Many, many churches and peoples will be celebrating that day. I know the Greek Orthodox will as well, and so will everyone else. But there's nothing like that festival at St. Jerome's. This has been the Chicago Way. John Cass, Jeff Carlin, and joining us this week were John Tillman from the Illinois Policy Institute, John Kosick, the crazy Croatian biker, and lamb cooker from St. Jerome's Church, who I hung out with overnight.
And Mark Hammergren from the Adler Planetarium, a planetary studier, making sure that we know we'll be okay when August 21st comes through.
See you next week.